Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5, for autumn semester 2017. Lecture 16, delivered on October 19, 2017. The title of this lecture is Stock.
Tonight, Stock. Now, a lot of what I'm going to show you, a lot of what I'm going to show you tonight, I've said at various points. And so this is where I bring it together into a more comprehensive framework. There's some math in this, nothing, it's not calculus. A lot of what I'm going to tell you tonight is the background and the qualitative aspects of the equity securities. Now, the first thing is that equity, which is our fancy word for stock, comes in two broad varieties, as I've pointed out before. There is preferred stock, and there is common stock. Now, each of these has subcategories, but they are both equity. They both represent ownership. One difference between them is that usually preferred stock doesn't have voting rights. Common stock does. Now, and another one is a preferred stock would get its dividend before a dividend would be paid to the common stock. If it's cumulative, then the company has to catch up on all of its back preferred dividends before it can do anything for the common shareholders. Now, so there's a difference right there. Preferred comes in the two different varieties. One of them is that some stock, some preferred is non-cumulative, some preferred is cumulative. Now, there's also a twist that I've seen where preferred stock has a convertibility feature that the company can, at some point in time, turn it into common stock. That's, of course, going to make that preferred stock less desirable, and therefore it's going to have to pay a higher guaranteed dividend to induce investors to invest in a stock that could turn into common stock. Now, on the excuse me, on the common stock side, there are sometimes, it's not particularly a usual thing, but there are times when we have companies, that there are some companies that have different classes of common stock. They have a Class A and a Class B. The Class A would probably be a security that would be held by the insiders, or by the, I should say, by the founding members of the corporation, a founding family. It would probably have super voting rights, like 10 votes per share, so that the family could control and hold on to the corporation come hell or high water. And then you would never be able to get your hands on that kind of common stock. You would be buying or selling the stock that would be the Class B, the regular one vote per share. Now, you can go to the meeting and vote your shares, the annual shareholders meeting. You probably would not do that. You will get off, if you own common stock, you will get a proxy card. The insiders, the management, and the current board of directors will say, please sign this card and give us your vote so we can vote for our team, kind of thing. That's the proxy card. And you, I mean, the worst thing is people throw those away. They don't even take it seriously. But the proxy card is something that you can sign and send back, and that gives the proxy sender the right to use your vote your shares for their positions. Interestingly, your vote really, unless you are a big 800-pound gorilla, your vote isn't going to count for much, for hardly anything. But there are times when you'll see groups with special interests buy a block of common stock of a company so that they can go to the shareholders meeting and put forth some proposal or have a say at the meeting about some issue. Like you'll have groups that say, well, we don't like your company's activities in these countries that abuse human rights. Or we don't like the fact that you are not pursuing green technologies. Other voting bloc groups. There are all kinds of special interests. There was one in the 90s, I recall, a group that was anti-smoking that bought a bunch of shares of Wendy's so they could go to the meetings and try to get Wendy's to go to a no-smoking policy in their restaurants back in the 90s. So you'll see those kinds of groups pop up. They generally don't have any power to change something, but they do have the power to go to the meeting and have a say. And sometimes these companies listen to them, sometimes they don't. But your vote probably isn't going to do a whole lot for anything. Now, in your world, I'm going to bring up something here. The company that I'll show you for the purposes of this demo of this evening in a little while I'll bring up this company right here once I get to that part, but that's in a little bit here. First things first. When a company issues stock, it could be their IPO, their initial public offering. They go public. However, much more common would be a company that is just raising more capital by going into the market for a later offering. You'll have some companies, in fact, that actually register with the SEC a big, huge amount of common stock. And then, as they need equity capital, they'll pull some of that off the shelf and sell it. This is called a shelf registration. If I'm not mistaken, Microsoft is one of the well-known users of this device. But one way or the other, the company will have to do an offering of its equity, common stock or preferred stock. Now, the first most what you would probably know about would be what is called a firm underwriting. A firm underwriting. Now, in a firm underwriting, you need stock in. You need to sell stock in your company. What I can do is I can be a lead underwriter. I'll say, yes, we will buy that entire issue. And that's a term we use. We will buy the whole issue. And then what I'll do is I'll put together a syndicate of other underwriters who will help me sell that once I've bought it. So you might issue a million shares. And what I would do then is I would say, I would put together the syndicate. Okay, I'm going to handle 500,000. You handle 200, 200, 100, 100, 100, 50, 50. And in that way, we distribute the burden of getting those shares unloaded. But that would, the first one, I get it from you, that is the primary offering. Everything after that is a secondary offering. Okay? So, the primary market, you yourselves will never probably buy stock in. You will buy in the secondary market. Someone wants to sell his or her stock, and someone wants to buy that stock, and those are matched by the electronics of our day so that it clears within split seconds. And I'll get into that more in just a minute here. Now, the firm underwriting, you will see there are several documents. I'm going to bring up their names for you right now. Make sure you get them down. The first thing is what is called a tombstone. A tombstone is not an advertisement, but it says XYZ Corp or whatever offering, say, 1 million shares, common stock, $10 per share, common. And then you'll see a big name, and then littler type, other names. That's the lead underwriter, the big name is, and underneath it. This is not an advertisement. It says right at the top of the document, this is neither an offer to sell nor an offer, a solicitation for an offer to purchase the securities noted below. The only document that can do that is the prospectus, which is available from, okay. So this is not a selling document. It's just a notification. You'll see these tombstones in financial papers all the time for all kinds. I mean, it's not just common stock. It could be bonds. It could be weird stuff. But the tombstone is just a notification. Hey, we're going to do this. Now, the amount that they put here is not what will finally be the final price. They'll decide that very close after the qualification, and I'll bring that up. Before I go on, the way it works is you have to go, I'll tell you when I did. The company is going to hire lawyers and accountants. Back in my time, I could do this. Now it would be illegal for me to do that kind of work myself, but the company's people, representatives or whatever, file a large document with the SEC. It could be a Form S-1, an SB-1. I'll tell you more about that in a subsequent lecture. But they file a big document. The middle of that document is called the prospectus. That's the selling document. The SEC is going to go through this with a fine-tooth comb. And if it is in due form and they have no problems, then the SEC will qualify the offering. The government never approves of anything. The term is qualifies the offering. And if it does that, it notifies the company, and then there is a quiet period. The company has to shut up about it. And there is a date when the offering can open. Now, during the quiet period, once the SEC is qualified, the company, that prospectus, the selling document, it can't use that, but it can use a version of it called the red herring. The red herring, H-E-R-R-I-N-G, is actually the prospectus, but there's red print in it. Especially on the first page. In other words, this is not the prospectus. This is a draft of the prospectus. And that can be, in a limited way, distributed to get interest. But no sales can happen off that red herring. Once the quiet period has ended, then it's a go. And the offering can start. Now, to give you the idea of what this is like in real life, and my story is a little bit different because I was a one-man show for the most part. I did an offering. It was a full-blown S-1, the big, heavy, 800-pound kahuna, gorilla. And I did this massive form S-1, all these disclosures at the front, then the prospectus, then these disclosures at the back. It was a monster document. And I sent it off to the SEC, and it was about a week later, I got a fax. This was before there was email. I got a fax, and my fax machine just kept running and running and running. 497 deficiencies. I almost passed out. I thought, well, you know, I'm just going to jump off this building now. I called an old consultant who had been a good friend of mine over the years, and I blubbered to him, 497 deficiencies? And he came back, well, that's not bad. What? He said, just fix them. Stop crying and just fix them. A lot of them were just technical stuff. Well, you didn't put this margin here, or you didn't put this section in the right place. Some of them were more substantive. I spent like 48 hours without any sleep, and I fix it up, send it off again, waiting for the SEC to come back with maybe 400 deficiencies. They came back with 5, and they were all just technical things I'd missed. And so I did it one last time, and sure enough, fax came through, qualification. It was done. The offering was a go. I swear, I went to White Castle, and I stuffed myself until I almost barfed on cheeseburgers. Celebration is every... We all have our own way. Don't judge me. But anyway, that gives you an idea. This is a major thing for a company to go through the public offering. It's a huge thing. And any of you who are going to be involved in a corporation, it will probably, if it's an IPO, it's going to definitely suck you in no matter what part of the corporation you're in. You'll have to do something in support of this. If it's not the first time they've offered stock, it will still be a big deal. And so you might even, if you're not involved in the directly, you could very well be pulled in. You have to provide these disclosures so that we can put them into the final, into the prospectus or something like that. So it will impact on you what I'm telling you about here. It's rare. It's a rare event. Don't get me wrong. This isn't an everyday event. That's what makes it so special. Selling the stock, selling equity in your company is a special thing. Now, I want to warn you about something. The SEC can qualify your offering, but then you still have to go to the states in which you are going to offer and solicit to sell stock. Almost every state will require, if you're going to sell that stock in our state, you have to go through our division of securities. Okay, some states, they just take the SEC. FCC says it's okay, we say it's okay, just fill out a couple of forms. Other states are absolute asses about it, and they will make your life miserable. And so sometimes I'm not going to sell stock in every state. And in my position as a consultant, I might go for 18 states to register. And I would avoid like the plague the states I knew were going to cause me major problems. And some states got really bad as scandals accumulated. They went after everybody. So you're going to have to go jump through the hoops of the states. So in other words, if you are a citizen of Illinois and you are hanging out with your relatives in the backwoods of Kentucky, you're a Kentucky kind of girl, but you now are a citizen of Illinois. The offering is registered in Kentucky, not in Illinois. However, if you hear of this, and I'm talking to you, I'm a broker, and I'm trying to get you to buy some of this stock, I could very well be tripping over a problem because I am trying to solicit for an offer to purchase to a citizen of a state in which I did not register my offering of stock. So I could get burned there. Now, I don't know. I tell you what I do know, and I also am very honest about what I don't know. I don't know how it works these days, but back in my time, they would get really nasty about things like that. And so you've got to watch your step. You've got to be careful of a lot of things when you're doing an offering of common stock. For one thing, when you're doing the offers to sell, or soliciting people to offer to buy the stock, you got to be careful that you're not going to stumble over things that you don't know about. One of the consulting gigs that I did I hate it when I can say many years ago, and it really was many years ago. But there was a company, it was in suburban Akron, and I'd gotten it through a mutual contact. They want to do an IPO. They've got something amazing. Well, you hear that all the time. So I drove up to Akron, and it was in this storefront, in this dilapidated shopping strip mall. And I went in there, and they wanted to give me a show. From what I had been told, The head of this company was a former CIA NOC. He was an independent contractor for the CIA. He had with him, as other officers of the company, a degreed engineer who was a firefighter, volunteer firefighter in this in suburban Akron, and a couple of others who were like early geeks, like I was, computer geeks. And I walked in there, and they gave me the demonstration right away, and I nearly dropped my jaw. This was in the late 1980s. They had it was in the early 1990s. They had a giant Budweiser can, a hologram spinning, and I could walk clear around it. This was technology this was science fiction back then. It was just amazing. And they explained to me how they had done it. They had actually, because it required such incredible stability of the cameras that were on it and the video recorders, which weren't digital in that time, they had dug a 60-foot pier down into the earth and filled it with concrete, a 60-foot hole and filled it with concrete to keep the stability of the system. They had developed a capability that later would be essentially what we call MRI. They could image a living heart, and then they could display it for heart surgeons around the world who could then advise the doctors who were actually going to operate on the guy, on the heart. Well, you've got to watch out. Sometimes there's a nerve right in there. Let's peel this back and see. Ah, there it is. It was amazing what they were doing. It was just jaw-dropping. And it was all, at least the technology was at least largely the result of this guy, this NOC, technology he had gotten in his years working with the CIA. They were doing this kind of imaging, even back then. Anyway, I went up there at one point. I tried to get up there about every week, and at one point I went up to Akron, and there was no one there. The storefront, it was closed. I looked in, all of the equipment that had been in there was gone. It just vanished. And I did investigation, I made calls, and I finally found out the Division of Securities of Ohio had gone up there to interview them. And they walked into a frickin' trap. Apparently, at some point, they were trying to do a self-underwriting, which I'll explain in a minute. They were selling stock, and the Ohio Division of Securities got wind of what they were doing, went up there and interviewed them, asked one of the engineers, "Are you paying yourselves from this offering you're doing?" And the poor fool said, "Well, we got to kind of eat while we're, have a little money while we're getting this ready to take to market." That was it right there. They had violated securities law by using the proceeds of the offering for personal purposes, as they touted it. They went to prison. The technology just vanished into the wind, as I saw on several other occasions, only to show up years later in the hands of some big company. So watch your step, because those ambitious state regulators are out for blood. A lot more than the SEC was in my time, and even is in this time. The next kind of underwriting is called a best efforts underwriting. Now, in a best efforts underwriting, the investment bankers or the brokers will not buy the issue from you. You want to issue 1 million shares, sell 1 million shares. I will say, I'm not going to buy this from you. Dream on. What I will do is contract with you to do my best to sell them. No promises. Okay, that's a best efforts. Now, I have an incentive to do this because I'm going to charge you out the wazoo in commissions. You want to sell that stock at $10 a share? Well, you're going to get $8. Now, that wouldn't be the case now, but it was my time. I'll make sure that it hurts. But if you can't find a firm underwriter, this is as good as you're going to get. The best efforts, and I did a couple of best efforts. where we worked. I got a syndicate together. I said, we're not on the hook for this, but look at what we can make if we get this stock unloaded for this little company. Okay? So it's a best efforts. So in other words, in an offering like that, you might actually, as a normal market participant, be able to buy the primary issue. So, but this would not be high quality stock. You'd have to ask yourself, well, why couldn't they get a firm underwriting? So you got to be careful about a stock like this. Clearly, the big dogs didn't want this on their plate, so they came to the sleaze merchants like me. No, like those other guys, and to do that. By the way, a best efforts underwriting is sometimes called a Western underwriting, as opposed to the Eastern boys who do the firm underwritings. It's called a Western underwriting or a Western style. Now, the last kind is what is called the self-underwriting. The company's own people try to sell the stock. Dangerous as hell to do it. Because you could trip up, make a mistake. There are all manner of things that you don't know about in securities law. I walked into it with all kinds of bravado, no problem. I was paddled as I learned. I was lucky. Fortunately, they knew I was trying my best, the regulators, and they guided me. They bitched at me. Sometimes they even slapped me across the face. But I got to the point where I did know enough to know that you watch your step, every step of the way. Don't make a mistake. But you can do a self-underwriting. It's just a risky thing to do. You could stumble. You're going to find that it's going to be easy to sell stock to your relatives and to a few friends, but then going beyond that, it's going to be 3 yards in a cloud of dust all the way to the other end zone. It's tough, but it's doable. I saw it done, and I also saw the offerings collapse because they couldn't get it done. And they'd come to me and say, aren't you going to help us with this? No, you didn't want me to do it. You got all kinds of excited when I told you what it would cost for me to do a best efforts. I'm out of this. This is company officials only. Don't try to get me involved because I gave you the best efforts option. You didn't want it, so you got to sell it yourselves. Broader point about watching your step doing, and I'm telling you this because some of you are going to go out there and be business people. You're going to start your own companies, and you're going to sell ownership in those companies. And you're going to have to watch your step no matter what you do. I'll give you a good example. Seasoned people from Wall Street. Story goes that they were having one of their power lunches at some place in the Manhattan area, and they were working out the details of a firm underwriting that they were going to do. They were writing things down on napkins, proposal for the price, how many shares, any kinds of special features, anything, just writing down, brainstorming over a good lunch. Well, they left, and they left the napkins. The waitress who waited on them gathered up the napkins and subsequently traded on the information. The napkins were determined by the relevant court as constituting a defective prospectus. It just on a napkin, that was a prospectus, and it did not meet standards. And it was a published prospectus, absent qualification by the SEC. All kinds of disaster for those idiots who left those napkins, just inconsequentially left the napkins on the table. That's how serious it can get when you're trying to sell stock. If you're going to do it, know what you're walking into. Find the lawyers that will help you. Don't ask me. I'm out of the business. I'm not allowed to do that stuff anymore, except for my own coin. And even there, it scares the crap out of me. Anyway. Now, before I go any further, that's kind of the background. Oh, real quick story. There is a brand of beer that kind of came on the scene out of nowhere a couple of decades ago. Now, you'd know it if I told you the name of it, but I won't tell you the name of it. They did what was essentially a self-underwriting. Now, in a self-underwriting, if it's a smaller amount of money, you don't call it a prospectus. You call it an offering circular. And I'll talk more about this later. I wrote a lot of offering circulars. But this beer company had a genius idea. Their beer was getting a following, rather noticeable following. It was decent suds. And so what they did was, now, they were going to do an exemption from full registration that allows you to raise up to a certain amount of money without doing all the really heavy stuff. You have to do some filings, but it's not the big stuff. So they did this sort of limited exemption, which allowed them to raise up to a certain amount of money, and they did it on a self-underwriting. And their idea was to put an offering circular in each of their six-pack bottles of beer. Just put the offering circular in there. So you're drinking your booze, and you're getting a little, maybe three sheets of the wind. Burp. Oh, this looks like a good car. I'll buy. They oversold the offering insanely, way over the limit that was allowed. They were just saying, oh my God, look at all this money coming in. Well, when the SEC found out what had happened, they ordered them to give back all of the money, all of it, and pay some rather nasty big fines for having oversold an offering, relying on an exemption that gave them a limit on how much they could raise. They saw all this money coming in. They were just, wow, we're really popular. Take it, spend it. We're going to really make this company big really fast. Well, they didn't. They had to give back every dime, even the money that was under the limit they had to give back. Plus, they had to pay those really big fines, and they were ordered to back off trying to sell stock for, a year. They couldn't do it again. So there you go. That's a good example. Watch yourselves out there. Now, I'm going to turn the attention away from this stuff. This is the primary market. I'm telling you about the primary market. The secondary market is the one in which you will live and die. You will almost definitely, you will be buying. If you say, I want to sell 1 million shares of stock. I don't know how you've got 1 million shares. You don't look that rich, but you got 1 million. So you call me, your broker, and I want to sell 1 million shares. And you're in the market. You want to buy 1 million shares. Well, you've got your broker you told to give a buy order to. Okay, so an electronic match would be made. You might actually want to buy 500,000, you 200 at a given time, you 300,000. So the matches will be made. You sell, you guys get. We'll get into that in just a little more detail here in just a second, but let me make a distinction here. This is legal business wording, and this is one of those steps that takes you so that your use of terminology, your understanding of what words means, is other than the common person. I've got to convince you, by the time you're finished with my course at least, that you ain't the average person anymore. You know more about words and what they mean, concepts and what they imply. Here, broker, agent, and dealer. A broker represents the buyer. An agent represents the seller. A dealer represents himself or herself. You need to know this distinction. It is important. So when you go to your insurance agent, that agent represents the insurance companies, not you. They'll try to get your business by getting a good deal for you, but you've got to understand, they don't represent you. If it says agency, agent, that means that they represent the seller of it. When you buy or sell, when you have a stock broker, he represents you to the market. So the broker word is very important. When you buy a house, you go through a real estate agent. That agent represents the seller of the house, not you, the buyer. You can actually go to a real estate person, and that person can stand as a broker. You could just go to a real estate person and say, I want you to represent me as a broker. I want to buy a house. That means that you don't go and try to sell me a house where you're the agent. That, or if you do, you've got a conflict of interest here. Let's talk about it. There are ways that they can get around this, and they swear to God they can do it on both sides. Don't believe it until you've got convincing proof. Because the word agent on its own means that that's the seller's person. You go to a real estate broker. In commercial insurance, rarely would a corporation go to an insurance agent. That company would go to an insurance broker for commercial insurance. Now, that's a big field, and there's a lot of money that can be made in it if you're good at it. We have one of the top schools in the entire nation here in insurance, and the director is known all over the world, and he loves it when I bring someone up there and say, all right, we've got someone who's interested in commercial insurance brokerage. And because that's what they're looking for in the big corporate world where the big bucks are. You see, the way it'll work is that let's say that I am an insurance broker. You're a corporation. What I can do is I can go to you and say, we can put together for you a package, an insurance package. You'll pay one premium to us, and then we'll take care of it from there. And then I will go and look at all of your exposures, how much where the indemnifications have to happen. And I work out, and then I call insurance companies. And I say, all right, I've got some exposures that you're pretty good at handling. Can you deal with these? You need to give me a quote on what you can do. Okay, this is an excess lines. You do excess lines. We need you to look at this part. I put together a package. Now, the next thing that I'm going to have to do is I'm going to say, okay, you're going to work with me on this? You like this company? Okay, good. I want a BOR. I want you to give me a broker of record letter. In other words, you can't talk to this evil competitor of mine who's also trying to get your business. I lock the market. Not that you're evil. You're just taking my money, and I deserve stakes. You don't. Okay, so bottom line is that I'm going to try to lock the markets as fast as I can so that when you go around, you're just bouncing off walls. That's brokering because I represent you. But I also have to take care of my own coin here. And once I've got you in my pocket promising a BOR, you got to give me a good deal. And then I work out an entire comprehensive package for you. I represent you, the buyer of the insurance. That's why they call it a broker. You got the idea of a broker? I've talked to you about agents. Now, dealer. Well, I'm going to go to the car dealer tomorrow. Yes, you are. That car dealer represents himself or herself. That's how it works. He'll have companies. There are some that aren't really dealerships. They are actually agents. And there's a little bit of slippage. They're allowed to say something that's really not true. But for the most part, if it's a car dealer, that's a person operating for himself or herself. You'll see there are all these car companies around town. There's this nice new facility being built at the corner of Fort Jesse and Towanda. And you'll see there at that car company, Subaru sign, VW, Lincoln, Mercedes-Benz, all the nice cars, big signs. Well, you see that that owner of that dealership, he will work with all these different car companies, but he buys his inventory and then he sells it on his own behalf. Now, in the world of stock brokering and stock trading and all that, you'll see all kinds of animals. A broker would be whom you would, I want to buy 1,000 shares of ADM. Okay, good. You want to buy 1,000 shares. I represent you. I call the floor trader. The runner goes out to the floor and tries to do the work with the floor trader. He'll go up to a specialist. A specialist is what they call it on the New York Stock Exchange, the NYSE. The specialist would be a specialist in certain companies. I'll look around, okay, ADM is over there. I got an order for 1,000 shares, all that kind of stuff, okay? That, however, for example, on the Amex, those are dealers. Those dealers buy their own inventory of, say, 10, 50, 100 stocks, and then they play for their own coin with buyers and sellers. That's a dealer. So they are specialists, but they are a special kind of specialist. The NASDAQ, God knows what's going on there. But anyway. Now, in the world of stock trading, You, madam, are a tiny little atom. Okay, you come up to me. I'm going to kick your ass. I didn't feel it. And all of these giant gorillas and goblins and monsters and zombies and Cthulhus are slapping me. I hate Cthulhu. He gets those nasty tentacle arms. Slap, slap. Ah! Okay, the point here being that you have no power. However, the way the markets work, shut up. The way the markets work is that small orders get to the front of the system. Back in my time, it was called the SOES, the Small Order Entry System. After that came the Superdot that helped orders that were small come to the front. Now it's called the System Book Limit Order, something like that. But you will get your chance. Even as a tiny little gnat, there is this thing that will help you get to the front of the line so that the big dogs don't just beat the hell out of you all the time. Okay, so there is that. There is that. Now, the thing, though, is that when you do a buy or a sell on stock, you do have to be careful about how you do it. If I say, okay, I want to buy DAG. That's right, it's after the close, so I can't see the bid and ask. Okay, I want to buy 1,000 shares of ADM. If you say it that way, you are implying in parentheses at market. In other words, whatever the price is, buy it. However, if you are smarter, you are going to give a limit. I want to buy 1,000 shares of ADM at $43.30 or better. In other words, don't buy it unless you can get it for $43.30 or lower. That's a limit order, okay? That's a limit order. Similarly, If I want to sell ADM at 4:30:15. So 1,000 shares of ADM at 4:30:15. Well, if you say that, then you've limited what they can do. They can't sell those shares at 4:30:10. They can't sell those shares at 4:30:05. If it's down there, you are just parked in the limit order book, which I mentioned before. And those limit order books are visible to everyone in the world to look at. But if you just say, I want you to sell 1,000 shares of ADM, well, good luck with that, because it might be, by the time that floor trader gets that deal done at market, ADM could have dropped through the ground. You understand what's going on here? Do limit orders, unless you are stupid or unless you're desperate to get rid of it. Now, sometimes, if you've got a hard cascade, and that's a technical term, you don't need to know that now. I'll talk to you about it later. But if you've got a hard cascade and you're joining the herd trying to get the hell out of a stock, putting a limit order in might not do you a whole lot of good, because you'll just be parked on that limited order book until the Lord comes back. Okay, so keep that in mind, is that in a hard cascade, you can put a limit on a sell to try to save a few bucks, but from the disaster. But you might not get that order by the time they get it to the traders. You might not get it in with a limit. So in other words, if there is a crash of the market, I mean, realistically, people are going to run for the hills. They're going to sell. And especially these idiotic programs, computer programs, they'll see selling and they'll sell. And then everyone, all the other computers, oh, he sold, we'll sell. And then the original computers, oh, they're selling, I'll sell. You can get these cascading effects that are really nasty. Now, in this time, the markets almost all have circuit breakers. In other words, there will be something that will keep the stock from going below a certain amount of drop on a given day. And the circuit breakers will pop, 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 pop across the markets. And then that ends trading on that stock or that index or on that whole market for a while until everyone gets their big boy pants back on. Okay. Those kinds of things. Keep in mind the limit order thing, because if you're going to trade with intelligence in normal times. Now, I'm showing you ADM up there, and I'll use that one for something in a little bit here. But stock indices, technically. The ones that you know about. NYSE, the New York Stock Exchange. You can see it right there. This company is on the NYSE. This is the golden place. The standards for getting your company's ticker symbol listed on the NYSE are insanely hard. Highly reputable, good companies are on the NYSE. And the NYSE puts its own reporting requirements on these companies, separate from what the SEC does. Once you're a public company, you're constantly reporting to the SEC. But if you're on the NYSE, they're going to make you dance for them too. And all these stock markets will. Now, another one. Okay, that's the NYSE. Another one that is big is the AMEX, A-M-E-X, the American Stock Exchange, AMEX. That's the one I told you about that has the deal that has the that odd thing with those dealers. I think they still have them. God, it's been so long. Okay, now the next one is the NASDAQ, NASDAQ. NASDAQ is mostly small companies, just huge numbers of them. It's like the blue light special. You can find stocks that are very cheap there. There are reputable companies there. Don't get me wrong about that. There are reputable companies on the, there a lot of these companies. Look, as I told you before, the NASDAQ, I got all the companies I got listed, all but one were on the NASDAQ. I actually successfully got one on the Amex. That was way too much like work. But the NASDAQ, they beat me up to prove that this company was worthy of a ticker symbol on the NASDAQ. Now, the NASDAQ is an electronic system, all electronic. There is not a physical platform for the NASDAQ. It's all kinds of computers connected all through the country. These are the big ones in the United States. Now, this is U.S. companies on these exchanges. However, there are foreign companies that have ticker symbols on, let's say, the New York Stock Exchange. But when you buy that stock, in quotation marks, you're actually buying something called an ADR, an American Depository Receipt. It's sort of like a receipt that says, by proxy, this is a share of this German GmbH company or something like that. It's not the actual stock of that foreign company. It's an American depository receipt that represents a claim of ownership on an equity share in the foreign corporation. So you can invest in foreign companies, on these, at least some foreign companies, by buying ADRs. Other indices around the world. Big one is the Nikkei, N-I-K-K-E-I, the Nikkei, the Japanese stock market. The big, okay, another one is the Hang. And in Europe, there are stock exchanges, but they don't call them exchanges. They call them bourses, B-O-U-R-S-E. It's a bourse. And there are a lot of those. Now, back to the United States. There are actually not just these big ones. There are regional exchanges, too. For example, some companies are listed on the Philadelphia Exchange. So when you're thinking about stocks, sometimes it might not hurt to check out what kinds of companies are on some of these regional exchanges that you might never have heard of. But they're out there, and they're very active. And the big dogs play in these markets all the time. They're in there because there are companies, and there were a couple of companies I put into that system. I got them ticker symbols. So it's worth your while to have a look at those nice companies, okay, from time to time. Now for a little bit of the technicals behind all of this.
This isn't hard math. I mean, I've shown this to you before.
But when you buy stock and you sell it at some time in the future, it'd be nice to know what you have made as far as a yield goes. But not just the total yield, you would like to annualize that so you can compare, because you're going to be buying and selling stocks and holding them over different time frames. Annualizing them gives you a platform where you're looking at apples to apples. So let's say that you buy XYZ. Now I'm going to stop using this term in a while. You'll start hearing me use the term, you go long. $1,000 at $13.86 per share common. You do this on, let's say, April 17, 2016. During your holding period, XYZ issues a dividend. Of 28 cents per share common. On October 28, 2017, you sell your position, your shares of XYZ. Now later I'm going to say you close your position. So subsequently you'll hear my language get a little more natural to what we use. You go long XYZ, 1000 XYZ at 1386 common. During the holding period, XYZ issues a dividend of 28 cents per share on October 28, 2017. You close your position in XYZ. That's a little more of the sophisticated way. Not quite all the way, but it's getting there. So now, your total yield is going to be the dividend yield and the capital gain. And the yield would be dividend divided by the price per share Your capital gain is going to be the price 1 minus the price 0 over the price 0, and minus beginning over beginning. This is your total. This would not be an annual unless you were right on the mark selling it 1 year after you bought it. But the first thing we want to do is get the total yield here. And the total yield in this case is going to be the dividend, 28 cents per share, divided by the price at which you bought the shares at 1386. And the capital gain is going to be your, did I write down what you sold it at? At 1507 per share. So busy yakking. Okay. So it would be 1507 less, what did I buy this stuff at? 1386 over 1386. So your total yield on this is going to be, find a nice calculator here. I'm going to do 28 cents divided by 1386 plus, open parentheses, 1507.07 minus 1386, close the parentheses, divided by 1386. So your total yield over the holding period is 10.75%. Now, very quickly, this obviously, you can put these two denominators together so that you can say it's the dividend. And they put a little one here to say sometime over the period, you got a dividend.
You could have actually gotten a couple. A lot of companies pay more than one dividend a year. They break up the dividend into pieces. Okay, so plus the capital gain, all divided by the price zero. So you could do it that way too. I mean, it's just your choice. But one way or the other, what I now have is the total yield. But I want the annualized yield. And I've done this before, and I'm going to do it again. You get these in the quizzes and the tests online. I give them to you. So just make sure that you know that this is out there. I'm going to put this in my memory. Okay? Now, what I first am going to need to do here is I'm going to need to go to a site where I can get the days between. I'm going to go to Google, and I'm going to do days between dates, and I'm going to kick this one right here. Now, the start date here, what was it, April? April what? 17th. 2016, was it? Yeah. And the close was on October the 28th of 2017. Okay, calculate the days between. 559 days. Okay, so now I need to turn that into years. In years, I would say, okay, I need to take, what the heck did I just do there? How much was that? 559 divided by 365. So in other words, I held it for 1.53 years. Now remember, the way you do it is it's 1 plus total yield to the 1 over the number of years minus 1. So I've got those years there, and I don't do this. Put it in a memory somewhere. I don't think someone has more than one memory. But I'm going to say 1.5315. 1.5315 years. So now I can do 1 plus the 10.75% all to the 1 over 1.5315 minus 1. And that'll get me my annualized yield. Boy, I wish I could store that one in memory, because this is going to cause some rounding error. Like I said, whenever you take an exponent and you've rounded it, that's where you get rounding error really bad. But there you go. So I'm going to do 1, no, let me clear this. Open parenthesis, 1 plus memory recall, that was where I had that. Nice number. Close the parentheses. Y to the X to the open parenthesis 1 divided by 1.5315. Close the parenthesis equals. Now I'm going to have to subtract 1. So my annualized yield was 6.89%, approximately, and there was probably some real bad error in there. The annualized yield was 6.89% on that investment. Now you can compare it, do the same thing with other things that you've bought and sold, and this will give you the ability to compare your performance on different parts of your portfolio. Okay, that's in a nutshell the hardest thing that you're going to hit in the math for this section. But I am going to give you a surprise quiz. It's an in-class, because I give you the information in class here tonight. Now, also, there will be, from the content of this lecture, some questions. They're no-brainers. Just if you took good notes, you got no problem with those.
But let me show you the company that I want you to use. When I say the company that was referenced in the lecture, I'm just going to type it in here and show you a couple of quick things. Okay. First of all, make sure you can see where the dividend is, okay? I mean, a lot of investors, they really are interested in this one. You notice that this is actually kind of a, not a spectacular dividend on this one. You see that? It's less than 1%. Dividend yield, of course, is the dividend divided by the price. So the dividend on this thing, and some information I wouldn't ask because it might change from day to day, but, this one won't change. This number won't change. Now, a few other things. Just keep an eye on your OBV, your on-balance volume, and things like that. Statistics is actually a decent thing to have a look at. Because not just for a quiz or something like that, but in general, notice all the ratios that are calculated there. You see them? And also, quick information, you got to be a little careful. See, right there, the dividend is given again. Dividend yield is given again. So a little bit more information than that front screen is this statistics screen. You can see some, it's not, you know, if you're going to do real hardcore analysis, this is at least a starting point before you get down to some fast stuff. A little warning, though. Oh, look at this. See all the ratios they give you? Balance sheet, income statement ratios, and a few of the mixed ratios. So one caution, though. Watch it. Don't go here for the financials. Go to the Edgar system, because I have had so many experiences where there was a glitch and the financials had a number wrong, or they had a blank where there really was supposed to be a number. And it's just that they absorb the information from the Edgar system, and those kinds of things do seem to always have the potential for a problem or two. So just kind of keep that in mind. Now, one other thing that I want to show you. Confounded. Oh, here. Look at this. You got your historical data. And this is worth you having. There are other classes you'll take as upperclassmen where they ask you for information about companies. And I mean, this is not the greatest resource in the world, but it sure gives you some information. Look, for every day, you can go back way back. You can get the open, high, low, settle, and all that kind of stuff. The volume for the day. So you can profile volumes. Download these to an Excel spreadsheet. And yes, it's pretty easy to, see it? Download the data and play with it. You can go to the, I think you can do that with the statistics too. Crap. Well, you can do the cheater's way. You just highlight the whole block and then you copy it and paste it into Excel. And Excel will probably be able to figure out what you've done. So even if you can't download the data, you can still do that trick. But anyway, so now you know what company I'm referring to. I'll have that up tomorrow night, or tomorrow at some point. You'll have the weekend to do it. You should ace it. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.